Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. This show is pre-taped, so we can't accept any calls, unfortunately. Our subject matter this evening is Venice, 500 years of Jewish history, tradition, and food. When we think of Venice, where they had the first ghetto in the world, in 1516, where all the Jews were forced to move into that ghetto, the images, the visions that we have of Venice are those of the most romantic city in the world, but there is far more to Venice than its canals, than its gondolas, the singing gondolieri that we see in the movies, the many, many books that were written, such as Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, and many others. There is a vibrant Jewish community. This evening our guests include Corrado Calimani from the Comunità Ebraica di Venezia and Alessandra Rovati, blogger par excellence from Dinner in Venice. Good evening, Mr. Calimani.
Good evening to you. It's nice to hear you.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Well, I was born in Venice, not long ago, but enough. And my family has been living in Venice for more than 500 years when the ghetto was founded. The first Calimani family lived there, and you know, we had many. First of all, we are Ashkenazi, and the first settlement in Venice were Ashkenazi, people coming from northern parts of Europe, and so our family settled down there, starting from the 1516, and the first synagogue, which was founded in 1538, is the German synagogue, was the synagogue of my ancestors. So, you know, we live with this community. We've been living with this community for more than 500 years today.
But the name Calimani doesn't sound very German.
Yes. But then, you know, at the beginning, the Ashkenazi population was the richest one. Then came the Provençal, the people coming from France, and then came the Levantine, coming from the eastern part of Europe and from Turkey and so on, and then came the Sephardi. And the Sephardi, they came after, they were chased out from Spain, but they came later on, they came around the 1585, and they overcome the Ashkenazi and the German German Jews, so they were richer, and they built a beautiful synagogue, a great huge synagogue, which exists still now, a day. As a matter of fact, we have five beautiful synagogues. As I told you, the first one was from 1538, and the latest one is the 1585. So people coming over to Venice, not only they can have a look at our beautiful synagogue, at our museum, to the silver crowns and to the silver limonim. We have a huge heritage, you know, of this five century history. So it's amazing what this community has kept. Unfortunately, the number of the Jews in Venice decreased in the last few years, and now the community counts more or less 450 people. With this richness of not only religious items but also monumental buildings and so on.
Let me speak for a moment with Alessandra, and we'll come back to you. I have a lot of questions for you. Good evening, Alessandra.
Good evening, Chaim. First of all, I want to interject with something that Corrado just said, that the community counts for 150 people. But I wonder if number even includes some people like myself who are still members but have moved elsewhere. I live in New York. I have friends who live in Milan and still keep their membership with the community because we're close with them, but we're not, unfortunately, physically there. So yes, it's now a very, very small community, but it's actually so vibrant that a lot of the cultural events that the Jewish community of Venice organizes every year, which they include conferences on Jewish studies, attract the rest of the town. So
tell us a little bit about your blog.
I don't know if I should define it as a blog or just a website where I give free recipes with a little bit of their historical background. It's called dinnerinvenice.com, and I started it right before Passover this year, and it's been very successful. My Facebook page already has 2,500 fans. I started this blog because I moved to the States from Venice in 1995, and for all these years I've been missing the food from home, and I've been calling family and friends and several of the nice ladies in our community who are famous for being the best cooks to get recipes and tips on how to make those foods here. And American friends constantly ask me for help with cooking recipes, so I decided to put it all online. Not only specifically Jewish Venetian food, but kosher Italian food in general. But I do feel particularly strongly about Jewish Venetian food because Venice was a crossroads of cultures. Especially in the 15th and 16th century, Jewish Venice was. And so our food was really cosmopolitan and fusion, and particularly interesting and exotic. And it was influenced by all the different groups of Jews that arrived in different waves of immigration from different parts of the Jewish world.
Not only have you recreated an Italian kitchen, as you say, but I am sitting here in your living room, dining room, and there is a very Italian atmosphere in this room. I mean, if I didn't know that I had walked in from the streets of New York, I would have said I must have walked in from somewhere in Italy.
Si Corrado will be proud of me because he's also in design. So. Are you proud of me?
Corrado, can you tell us a little bit about when the Jewish community first started arriving? At least, what are the earliest known records of Jews arriving in Venice?
Well, you know, people say that there are records that Jews lived in the mainland, not so far from Venice, but in the mainland, because Venice is situated in there are 108 islands that comprehend Venice, and they are connected by bridges, you know. So, but in any case, in the mainland, it's about 7-8 miles from Venice, in the lagoon, and mainly that there were some families, some Jewish families, merchants, they say, living already on the 12th century. And the Jews lived also near Padua at the same time. Not so far from, not in Padua itself, but near Padua, in Piove di Sacco and so on. And there were small communities, small keilot, but a keila, a community, was made perhaps over five families that kept together, had minyan, and so on. So later on, people say that there are records that the Jews lived in an island called Judaica. That's the name, Jews, Judaica, you know, Judea, perhaps, but it's not so sure. They say that, that there was a settlement there around the towards the 13th century and so on. But in 1516, the Serenissima Republic, the Venetian Republic, decided to give a place called the ghetto to the various families, Jewish families, living around Venice. And the word ghetto comes probably, perhaps, because we are not sure yet, because nobody knows the real origin, comes from foundry, from a foundry. There was a foundry in the original place of the ghetto, and ghetto means it's something that has to do with the foundry. So it's like a fountain of melted iron or metal. This is ghetto. From that comes the word. And then the first to arrive, as I said before, were the Ashkenazi, the German ones. And then came the Provençal, people coming from France, and then the Italian Jews that came mainly from southern Italy or from Rome and so on. And then the Levantine later on, and the Sephardi. The Levantine were merchants, they had connections with Greece, with Turkey, and so on. And the Sephardi, the Spanish, had connection with the Dutch Jews, had connection with the Portuguese Jews, that were spread around Europe. So there were five nations. And it was incredible. They didn't get along very well. Every nation used to fight against the other.
Well, we still don't, right?
It's usual. It's a habit among Jews, you know. It's a habit. I mean, you have two Jews, three ideas. So
absolutely,
you know, was normal at that time. And they also had a big problems with the Serenissima, because the Serenissima tried to keep them quiet, but there were public judgments, you know, the terrible things happened. But at the same time, the ghetto flourished and had a lot of culture. There were famous rabbis, Leon Modena, famous poets like Sarah Sokopiusulam, famous other rabbis, very famous rabbis like Simcha Kalimani, for example, my ancestor, that wrote a Hebrew grammar, for example, around.
That's Torah's great
grandfather. So, a lot of culture in any case. But the peak, their peak, the Jewish community, let's say the five nations, their peak of population, they arrived to be, they were in the ghetto, lived towards the end of the 18th century. There were 5,000 people living in this small area. You can imagine 5,000 people all crowded in...
it's worse than Manhattan.
Because in Venice, you know, we don't have very high houses, but tall houses. Only in the ghetto you find skyscrapers of Venice. Only in the ghetto. Because the ceiling, for example, sometimes in some houses, it's only 1.80 meters high. So you can imagine one flat on top of the other, because there was no space inside the ghetto.
What was the relation of the Jews with the church throughout the history of the ghetto? Was the church very oppressive?
You must reckon that there was the Inquisition, and the church has always been against the Jews, and especially in the Vatican State, I mean, in Rome, was a terrible life for the Jews living in Rome, because the Pope was not so kind, was not so gentle. But in Venice, the Jews had a better life, because the Serenissima didn't accept the Inquisition in Venice. So the Jews were, let's say, safe from this pressure and from this persecution. And so, but they had to live in this restricted area. They opened the gate of the ghetto in the morning, early in the morning, and they used to close at sunset the gates of the ghetto. But if a Jew was found outside the ghetto after sunset, after the gate had been closed, then he would have been put in prison. And the Jewish community had to pay the guardian that looked after the gates of the ghetto. So it was not an easy life, even in Venice, but was a better life than in other regions or places in Italy.
Or in Europe.
Or in Europe, yes.
Can I just mention one of the very famous people who moved to Venice from the Iberian Peninsula? Was Itzhak Abarbanel. So a lot of very, very famous intellectuals in Venice in those days.
He actually moved to Venice before he moved to Eretz Israel.
Yes.
Because the family in Eretz Israel today in Yerushalayim,
yes,
it's a very big famous family.
Yeah, he was also in Venice.
Now, one thing I would like to understand. Here in America, we have basically Nusach Ashkenaz with a few variations within Nusach Shel HaSfaradim, Edot HaMizrach, with a few variations. The Nusach of the Roman ghetto is completely different from both the Sephardim and both from the Ashkenazim. Can you explain a little bit of the differences and then the differences between the various communities?
Well, you see, I think the Roman population, the Jewish Roman population, was the first to settle down in Italy, because they came after
the
was destroyed in 70 after Christ, let's say. It's also Jewish to say after Christ.
Well, 70 of the current era.
So they came with Titus. And they settled down in Rome. They had people, they found a very old synagogue nearby Rome in Ostia that goes back to that time. You know? And they had different, you say Nusach, I say Minhag. Let's say they had a different, they are Italkim, they are in Italian Jews. And it's a different, they sing differently. They say a different Kaddish, for example.
Right.
And, you know, there are some, I mean, the prayers are always the same, but sometimes they say the prayers are slightly different. They sing in a different way. For example, in Venice, at the beginning, we had only
Corrado. Can we just explain first of all that we don't daven in the Roman slash Italian Nusach in Venice, because in Venice we now follow a more Sephardic Nusach that's more similar to the Spanish Portuguese. Because I think it may not be clear to the people who are listening. Yeah.
Yes. Well,
thank you.
Let's say that. Okay. So let's say that we had at the beginning there was only the German population. I mean the Ashkenazi, and they had their own Nusach, Minhag, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then when the Sephardi or the Levantine came to Venice. They transformed the community, the Ashkenazi almost disappeared, and they integrated with the Sephardi and the Levantine. So we started having only one Nusach, that is the Sephardi one.
Because they had more money?
Because
they had more money, right?
They had more money. They come.
So they paid the rabbi. They paid the chazan.
Yes. They paid the rabbis, famous rabbis. They paid them more, and you know the rest of the Jewish population impoverished because the banks had problems and so on. So now let's say that in Venice we are. An Orthodox community with Sephardi, Minag, or Nusach. The Sephardi Minag, it's something that likes singing, likes beautiful music, and so it's completely different. It's completely different, and we carry on with this kind of. Religious tradition, let's say, and if you come over to Venice on Shabbat, you'll hear the community sing our beautiful songs, our Lechadodi, our Igdal, and it's something amazing. But you can recognize yourself in the same music, the same singing that you find perhaps in the Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam. So we kept this kind of minag, let's say.
And Corrado, I have an interruption. It's kind of a cool thing because I just saw that on your Facebook page, because if you don't know, Chaim, the Jewish community of Venice just recently, last month, started a Facebook page in English to stay in touch with all its friends, all its non-Italian speaking friends. It's Jewish Venice or Jewish Community of Venice on Facebook. You can Google it. But on you or whoever is responsible for the page had just posted something interesting. An Israeli blogger who has a very cute blog called Nusach Freak. Che Corrado in italiano vuol dire il maniaco dei Nusach, where he analyzes and reviews different synagogues around the world, put a post in his blog about Venice and the Italian, you know, Jewish community, the our synagogue in Venice, which is really nice, and I can read it to you because it's very cute. It says that while in a lot of Ashkenazi modern Orthodox schools, the chazan will not even be able to carry a tune, and we're not offending anybody. I'm reporting somebody else's words. In contrast, in Venice, between Kabbalat Shabbat, Arvit, Zemirot, Shachrit, Kriyat HaTorah, Musaf, and Mincha, not a single mistake was made. There is no formal chazan in shul, but surprisingly, on Shachrit was led by a kid who looked no older than 22 or 23 and did not exactly look yeshivish. He looked more Italian, fresh out of an espresso bar in Milan, a typical Venetian local. But his kazaning was perfect. Everything was said out loud, and his dikduk, nusach, and transitions between the nusaki and singi bits were 100% perfect. So that's the review that we got by nusachfreak.blogspot.com.
Well, 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 well,
It's on your Facebook page, which some younger generations in Venice are maintaining. You haven't seen because you don't have Facebook.
Yes, because we have a very good Talmud, at least we have had a very good Talmud Torah, so our children, they learn how to say Tefillah or to Tefillot, and they, you know, on Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, they go on the Teva, and they pray loud for the congregation. I mean, it's nice not to have not only the rabbi or the chazan or the assistant rabbi, but the whole community takes part to the service. And it's part also of the service, because if our children go on the Teva, or the Bima to pray, then it's a pleasure for us. I mean, not only for fathers, for the father and the mother, but also for relatives and for the congregation itself. Let's say that lately, maybe we started with this kind, not only the Chazan, which is who's paid for this task, but also the youngster. We had a fantastic Yom Kippur. The youngsters were all singing and they were praying, and it took us very much, you know.
Well, I have not been to Venice, but I have been to Rome many times. And what you said is also true of Rome. I remember in 1970, my first time at the Great Synagogue right outside of the Roman Ghetto, which at the time was still being fixed. I think it's been fixed for about 500-600 years at least. They never finished it. Anyway, so... Yes, when I picked up one of the local Sidurim, I found it a little bit confusing as an Ashkenazi, but...
Yes, because it's written in Hebrew, but it's Italian Minag.
Right.
Nothing to do with the Sephardi.
Right.
Years ago, I was in Vienna. I was in Wien, and I went to the synagogue. And although I'm Ashkenazi, because my family is Ashkenazi, I forgot how to be an Ashkenazi. I couldn't follow the service. I can read Hebrew, but at the same time, I couldn't follow how they prayed in such a strict way, you know. I couldn't follow them. I didn't enjoy the Shabbat. I didn't enjoy it at all.
Also, I am sure their pronunciation was very, very different.
Yeah, the pronunciation was difficult. A few months ago, I was in Paris. I went to Sephardi, but it was half and half. It was an Egyptian synagogue. I succeeded in following the service. It was fantastic for me. But now that when I say I'm Ashkenazi, I'm ashamed because the only thing that I have of Ashkenazi remembrance is that I like gefilte fish. That's the only thing.
You like gefilte fish? You must be more Ashkenazi than me then.
Okay, but we have some in our family. We kept some recipes or something, you know, from the Ashkenazi kitchen. But my mother was Levantine because she comes from a Greek family.
Corrado, scusa. Let's explain what Levantine means, because it may not be clear in English. Levantine Jews, by Levantini, we mean the Jews who came from Greece or the Ottoman Empire, Turkey, as opposed to the Ponentini, which are the Sephardim that come from Spain and Portugal, from the Iberian Peninsula. So the Levantines are the ones from Turkey and Greece.
Sorry.
Besides, Besides Turkey and Greece, did any of the other Middle Eastern countries...
No. Yes, because the Levantine were mainly, they were merchants. They were merchants, they had ships, they owned... There was a very rich community in Corfu, the island of Corfu, and there were people that were really, really rich. As a matter of fact, when they opened the gates of the ghetto, many, many Levantine families left the ghetto and went to live. They bought nice palaces on the Grand Canal and so on, you know. Very few families, but these few families were rich, were very rich. So they started a new life outside the ghetto. And they started getting away from the crowd living in the ghetto. So in Venice, we started having, you know, the rich and the poor. And the rich started making mixed marriage and so on. But people living in the ghetto, they kept their tradition, they got always married with Jews and so on. And then the war came on, the Second World War, and, you know, the Shoah and all those sad things. And the community decreased. There were about 1,200 people living in Venice before the Second World War. At the end of the war, there were about perhaps less than 1,000 Jews. And as I said before, now we are more or less 450. But let's say that we increased the number. We were 430, now we are 450. We are trying to bring young families in Venice to live, to help to have a new life, new young life, if possible, just to reach the community. But it's not so easy, you know. We hope, for example, that Argentinian Jews would gladly come to Italy because the language could be more or less like Italian, but near to Italian. Spanish is rather similar to Italian, I mean, especially to Venetian dialect. But they prefer to go to Spain because it's
almost the same language.
Yes, it's the same language, you know. So you must reckon that in Italy there were till 10 years ago, perhaps 35,000 Jews. Now there are only 23,000 Jews left. So I don't know. Many went to Israel. Many went abroad. Many started a new life somewhere else. But I mean, Jews in Italy, I don't mean to say they're disappearing, but they probably continue their living in Milan and Rome. And that's it. Small communities are disappearing.
Why are the communities disappearing? As a rule, after World War II, the Italian governments have not been anti-Jewish, and certainly the current government under Berlusconi seems to be very pro-Israel.
Yes, Berlusconi is pro-Israel. The fact is that Berlusconi is spoiling Italy. It's ruining this country. And for us, it's a big problem. Of course, he's pro-Israel. He's also pro-Jews. I mean, he's got nothing against Jews. We start having problem because of the Kashrut with the Lega. With the Lega, which is part of the government, they want to stop the kosher meat. They want to stop the killing of the animals according to our law.
These are some of the parties. The League is one of the parties that are in the government now.
The League is one
in the coalition.
The majority in the government, you know. And as a matter of fact, a few days ago, they wanted to have a law approved that stopped the kosher meat, the kosher meat. And this kind of thing starts worrying us because they are against the Arabs, the Muslims, and they start being against the Jews. Because because they want that to cancel our tradition. They say that this kind of killing hurts and makes suffer the animals. It's not true. It's not true, because Jews never had the animals to suffer. He never wanted to make them suffer. So there are problems now. There are problems. I don't know what will happen, because if they stop me from eating kosher, I will probably go somewhere else where I can eat kosher. But I don't want to live in a country where they don't allow me to be free. And that's very bad. You know.
Now, going back for a second to the first Jews in Venice.
Yes.
You said they were Germans. Were these German Jews that came in at the time of the German emperor who called himself the great Roman emperor, Friedrich Barbarossa? Did they came when he invaded Italy? Was that the time when the Jews first came?
Let's say the Jews have always lived in Italy. They, as I told you before, some came from northern part of Italy, and people say that Jews were living at the court of how do you call it, Charlemagne. I don't know how you say in English.
Charlemagne.
Charles the Great. Charlemagne. In 800. As a matter of fact, people say that Carlo Magno, whatever it is in English, had a finance minister who was Jew. So those families, after the pogroms, after persecution and so on, around the year 1000, so they came southern, and many of them settled in Padua, in the surrounding of Venice, and so on. You know, and many other Jews came from south. I mean, from Naples, from Rome, because Naples was under the Spanish empire, let's say. And after in 1492, when the Jews were expelled from Naples and from later on from Portugal, and then they were also expelled from Naples. So the Jews living in Naples, they started coming up to northern Italy, not to the Vatican where the Pope was, but higher up. So they arrived to Ferrara, Padua, and again to Venice. So they were very migration, you see, from all over Europe.
Corrado, I just wanted to add something to what Corrado was saying, which is very interesting, because as far as the Ashkenazi Jews were concerned, it's a little different from the later migrations of the Sephardic Jews, because the migration of the Sephardic Jews was kind of sudden, and it's something that we can pretty much date to a very, very specific period, whereas the Ashkenazim arrived more slowly in different waves, because what was going on, that was a very, you know, very extended area of Europe that we're talking about, where Ashkenazi Jews came from. And in those areas, in the Middle Ages, we had a spreading of these urban myths about Jews, which ended up causing very, very strong persecutions in those areas. In particular, there was this legend, this myth of the poisoning of wells, which spread around a very, very wide area of Europe, where they said that the Jews were poisoning the wells, and actually became much more elaborate. I think Carl Ginzburg, in one of his books, Ecstasies in English, says that that he explains that the myth became so elaborate that it says that it was the Jews hiring lepers to poison the wells, and both the Jews and the lepers worked for the king of Granada,
who was a Muslim. But what this ended up causing was, in those times, was a major burning at the stake of Jews and lepers, and then they were burning, you know, who they thought were witches and a lot of people. And of course, like, but these spread over different areas in different years, and so the immigration to Venice from Ashkenazi lands was not something that happened overnight, but it went on for, you know, over centuries.
Town not so far from Venice, about 140 kilometers from Venice, it's called Trento. Trento is in the northern part of Italy, and in Trento, there's a story. They found a child. He had been killed. I don't know, but in any case, they said it was the Jews. There was a small Jewish community living in Trento, and this community was persecuted, and they were killed. They were all killed because they said they had drunk the blood of this young this child, and it was not true. Somebody killed the child, and you know. So they were expelled from Trento. So many of them perhaps came to Venice, because Trento was dominated by an archbishop, a Catholic archbishop, of course, and he had the interest to chase the Jews, and so they said that they were guilty, that they killed this child, and they drank his blood. So these stories in the Middle Ages are current, you know, and so that's why all the small settlements, the Jewish settlements, one day or the other they had to leave from the lands that were sieged, let's say, but the Catholic Church, because of course they hated the Jews, you know.
Now, you're getting ready to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the founding of the ghetto. Can you tell us a little bit about the festivities planned and when they will actually be starting?
In 2016, we will remember, and it's not a very glad occasion, you know, because being close in a ghetto is not something I wouldn't like to remember that in any case. But we have to give a cultural meaning to this kind of anniversary, and so there'll be an exhibition of what the ghetto was and the history of the ghetto and the culture that the ghetto gave to the Serenissima, to the town, and to the region, and also to the other people belonging to other religions. I mean, the way of living that there was in Venice was unique, I think, in Italy, because Jews lived, let's say, although the ghetto closed them inside, they lived fairly well. They were not armed, you know, and so they could profess their religion. So we are trying to remember these kind of things instead of remember only the closure of the ghetto. And there will be conventions, as I said, and then we are still organizing the program, but the government will be involved, and the region and the province and everything, and we are putting down several things that we are trying to develop, but we have 4 years in front of us, so it's just a matter of choosing. We have a terrible choice, a terrific choice, because Venice is full of Jewish history, because Jews left a mark on this city, on this town, you see. Also, the many noble families had Jewish Jews and so on. And then, in any case, we are strictly mixed with the history of this rich and unique city. I mean, so I can't tell you more because we still are making plans. So, but it will be something very, very, very impressive and important at European level, let's say, at least.
Well, you've already piqued my interest, and there is no question I'm going to try to be there.
Yes, you're invited.
Meanwhile, he's going to try all the food here.
Also, the father is invited.
Now, let me ask you one question.
Yes.
Although I was never fortunate enough to be in Venice yet, two of my kids actually did, and they tell me that they got through everywhere through the canals. Now, on Shabbat, how does one go to the synagogue?
Well, you know, in Venice we have the roof, which means that you can carry whatever you want on Shabbat. So there's no problem. And in any case, I rather walk instead of taking the boat as a bus, of course, because if I have to go from the ghetto, for example, I don't live in the ghetto. I live nearby the ghetto in any case, because I forgot to tell you that now in the ghetto there are very, very few families left. They all live outside the ghetto because nobody wants to remember what the ghetto was and how Jewish people lived in the ghetto.
And the ceilings are very low, but Venetian Jews today are all very tall and handsome, right?
Oh, yes. Thanks very much. Thank you. But in any case, let's say that I like walking around the city instead of taking a boat and because the boat is very slow, you know. Otherwise, you have to take a taxi, and according to my taste, costs a lot of money. So I'd rather walk.
Yeah, there are, you know, Venice is a cluster of a lot of little islands, but they're all connected by over 100 bridges, and so you can pretty much walk everywhere. It's like 2 square miles. It's not a big city.
It's like in Amsterdam. You walk along the canal, you have bridges, and Amsterdam is called the Little Venice in any case, but I mean, it's easily. And you know, one thing that I love about Venice is that there is no danger. There's no danger for the children, no danger, you know, for anybody. It's a quiet town, and you don't have any car.
Unless you are run over by the crowds of tourists. But Corrado, going back to the Eruv, can you explain a little bit exactly where it extends to? Because I think there is a small, like, it's controversial. There is this small area which is not included, which is the area near Piazzale Roma, where the buses arrive, right? That's not included.
Venice is made. Venice is there are more than 100 islands, and they are all connected by bridges. But the area from the railway station to all around the ghetto, you have the roof. So if somebody religious arrives and takes an hotel nearby the station, has no problem to walk with some things.
And also the area of Rialto.
Yeah, but you know, it's controversial because we have a map which has to be renewed, and the mayor of Venice has to undersign this map as the real map, because the rabbi goes to the mayor and the mayor has to undersign, and then it's official, you see. And every year we start changing a bit, but in any case there's a big area that comprehends the roof. So the ghetto, of course, is inside the area, and it extends more or less from the railway station to Rialto and almost to Semarco Square, almost to Semarco Square. But in any case, so the center is included.
By the way, you mentioned the rabbi, and this rabbi is so new that I haven't really had time to meet him yet, being in New York.
I don't know whether you met him, but because he arrived in Paris in January this year, and he comes. He was a former assistant rabbi in Madrid, in Spain, and he also worked in Milan as assistant rabbi for 3 years with Rav Laras. And then he also was in Miami, in New York. He's a young man, he's a nice man, he's a very active man, you know, but he's originally, he is Israeli. He's Israeli. And he comes from Israel, but his family comes from Yemen. But there he is. He's a nice rabbi, and he's full of strength, and he wants to do many things for the young people.
And what's his name? His name?
Gili Benjamin. His name is Gili Benjamin. He's young. He's 35, and he's not yet married. We are looking for a nice girl for him.
Can we advertise this time?
Yes, we advertise.
Well, you are so funny.
Nice,
you can.
Clever and a religious girl. Young, possibly young.
And now let us turn to Alessandra and talk a little bit about Italian food and Venetian food specifically.
So, thank you, first of all. And as I was saying before, Jewish Venetian food in particular stands out compared to Jewish foods from other regions of Italy. Food in general in Italy is very regional, Jewish and general food. Mm-hmm. It stands out because, as Corrado was explaining, we come from a large mix of people from different parts of the world. And so Jewish food in general is already a little bit more was everywhere a little more fusion than non-Jewish food, because Jews were always forced to move quickly from one place to the other, or also in other cases they were merchants, and so they traveled more than others. But in Venice, this particular trait is even stronger and more obvious because of the 5 different nations that contributed to our development. And at the beginning, each had their own traditions and food, but then they started merging. In particular, contrarily to what a lot of our Ashkenazi listeners may think, there was also a very strong Ashkenazi tradition in the food as well. And one of the most obvious examples of this was the use of goose in all its possible uses, from eating the meat, roasting it, and creating a lot of delicious cold cuts, imitating, in terms of technique, the Gentile cold cuts. We have goose prosciutto, which is obviously kosher, to using the fat for cooking meat dishes. In fact, a lot of people think of olive oil as the basis of Italian food and Italian Jewish food, but that was not always true, because one part of Italy was using olive oil, but another, northern Italy and the east of the Apennino Mountains, people for many centuries did not really use olive oil. They used mostly butter for dairy dishes, mm-hmm. and the Jews had, were using goose fat for meat dishes, it was Venice still has a lot of these recipes that are very different from non-Jewish food, especially in the use of the sweet and sour, a combination of the use of vinegar with raisins or maybe some sugar or honey in the recipe. And that's, you know, that used to be a specifically Jewish trait of food, a different flavor from what people would normally eat. Something that's remained a little specific to Jewish food, especially traditional food for the holidays, because for every day, I think things are getting more uniform, including like in the past few years with more traveling, more television. We can't say that Italian food in general is as regional as it used to be because people have been reading cooking magazines and they have been vacationing in the south from the north and watching television. So, you know, so for example, I was born in the 60s, and when I was growing up, already we used to have pasta with tomato sauce almost every day, and it's not a typically Venetian food at all because tomato sauce, you know, is something that came from the south and from Naples, and going out for pizza once a week is not also an ancient Venetian tradition. It's something that comes from Naples, but already in the 70s, this was what all Italians would do regularly. So
I grew up in Uruguay, and going out for pizza was not a once a week. That
right.
was once a day.
But I like to think that, like, for the holidays, people are much more traditional. Not only Jews, and so say, like, even some flavors that taste a little, you know, a little exotic and sort of old, if we ate them every day, because I think that the general taste for food in Italy has become more minimalistic and simple. And this is, I think it's part of the Tuscan heritage, with the, like, peasant Tuscan food. So instead of using a lot of spices and a lot of flavorings, like, take the best ingredients and make very, very simple, like, delicate food that enhances the flavor of the single ingredient. And I think, like, in general, that's a direction that, in general, for everyday Italian food has taken. But for the holidays, both Jews and Gentiles, I think, like to be more traditional, and you will find dishes that represent cuisine the way it used to be, really, like 300, 400 years ago. And one of the things that are very, very specific, I think, to Italian Jewish food is this taste for a sour flavor, the flavor of vinegar, which is very interesting because adding vinegar to cooked foods or during the cooking was a way to help food last. So obviously it was particularly helpful to Jews because food could be cooked in advance before Shabbat and the holidays, and, you know, we didn't have GE refrigerators back then. But in the case of Venice, it's a tradition that spread to the, or was used also by the Gentile population, because Venice in general was a nation was a place whose economy was based on international trade, and so merchants, which were not only Jews, by the way, because, and especially until the 1500, when after the losses at Lepanto with the Turks, Venice was sort of forced to bring Jews from the Ottoman Empire to do most of its international trade, because the Ottoman Empire didn't want to trade with the Venetian aristocracy anymore because they were at war with each other. But in its beginning, Venice was a country whose aristocracy itself based its power in the wealth accumulated through international trade. So it was an aristocracy of merchants. And so all these merchants would, you know, go away for months on this ship, and with some of these cooking techniques, they were able to eat some real food on the ship. Actually, there's a technique of cooking fish in Venice, which some say has Jewish origins, but is now like the signature dish of Venice, which is even served on the Christian holidays, and it's served in any, you know, you can eat it at any cafe as an appetizer. It's called pesce in sapore. Literally, it means fish in flavor, but it's made with either sardines or sole fillets, which are first deep fried, and then they are cooked with onions, vinegar, white vinegar, and either sugar or honey. And the Jews also add raisins and pine nuts into it. This is a very, very ancient dish. And it's one example of cooking that makes this fish last a week if kept outside without refrigeration. It's like, it's probably a very, very scary idea to us, but this type of fish is served in cafes in Venice. It's kept on the counter, not in the fridge, and it really, you don't get sick because this sealing the fish with the frying and then marinating it in hot vinegar is a technique for preserving food. And I think in a lot of Middle Eastern places, what they use instead for similar purposes is they do a very, very heavy use of spices. So these are just some examples of special things. And, of course, in the sweets, we see the Sephardic influence as well in the desserts because we do a lot of almond pastries. Almond-based pastries and cakes and desserts.
Good. And we're just about out of time. This has been a fascinating show. I want to thank both my guests. Thank you, Corrado, for calling us all the way from Venice. Thank you for giving us your time. Thank you, Alessandra, for the fascinating explanation on food. As a matter of fact, it's a perfect introduction for a show we will be having at the end of November, where a restaurateur from Little Italy in Providence, Rhode Island, Joe Potenza, will be talking to us about his fascination with the history of Italian food, specifically, even though he's not Jewish himself, specifically the history of Jewish food throughout Italy.
Yay.
And this was very, very good introduction. Both of you were superb guests, and I hope we will have you on again soon.
Corrado, what's the web page if people are interested in information because they want to come to Venice about Jewish Venice? I forgot your web page. I'm looking it up. It's jvenice.org.
I don't remember.
No, l'ho vista, l'ho trovata. I found it. It's jvenice.org.
Alessandra, remember one thing. The people say that probably, rice and beans, risi e bisi, is a Jewish Venetian recipe.
Yeah, yeah, all their risottos. I mean, Venetian Jews were famous for making risottos with everything.
So, risi e bisi probably has a Jewish origin.
That's rice with green peas.
Okay. Alessandra, grazie di tutto.
Figurati, grazie a te.
Saluta Chaim, ciao.
Thank you very much, Corrado.
Next to you, Chaim. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
And give us again, please, your website.
So
address.
My website, which is about kosher Italian food with free recipes, is Dinner in Venice, all one word, dinnerinvenice.com. And the website for the Jewish community of Venice is jvenice.org.
Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week. Thank you, one and all. Good night.